Diabetes affects 330 million people worldwide, and if untreated, can cause serious long-term complications, even death. Sherry Koldberg teaches exercise physiology and nutrition at Old Dominion University. She herself has had diabetes since childhood and is determined to rise above it. She's written several books about the disease. Her latest is targeted specifically for the Latino population.
Right. It's called Diabetes No Problema, and it is addressed directly to the Latino population because they do have special concerns related to diabetes. Some of them are cultural, maybe a little hesitancy with their older population to even see a doctor or to take medications. I think that we need to, with those populations in particular, really help them address their lifestyle and how they can integrate changes that are culturally based that allow people to make healthier lifestyle choices.
Why is the risk for developing diabetes higher than average among Latinos?
The risk for developing diabetes is based on a number of things, genetics being one part of it. But there's a lot of ongoing research in epigenetics and things that can turn certain genes on or off. And I think there are culturally based things, foods that people eat and other factors that may put the Latino population at higher risk than most for developing any type of diabetes.
Is it a problem that people are coming to this country, immigrating to this country, and then developing diabetes more here than they would have in their native land?
Yeah, and actually that's completely environmental. They found a population at risk here in the United States, Pima Indians. They also found a group of Pimas in Mexico that basically had the same genes, from the same gene pool. But over half of the Pimas in the United States have type 2 diabetes, and none of them in Mexico had diabetes. And the difference was lifestyle entirely, food, diet, activity, everything. So the Mexican Pimas were still sort of an indigenous people. They were growing their own food and they were eating a lot of natural foods. They were more physically active and they weren't overweight. You take that same population and you give them an American diet. I think you give anybody an American diet, they're more likely to develop type 2 diabetes.
So is it exclusively the American diet that is triggering diabetes in Latinos, or is there also a problem with it in the homeland for some groups?
No, there is a problem with it in the homeland. The example I was giving you with the Mexican Pimas, they don't eat a typical diet for a more industrialized country. You take those people and you put them in cities, Mexico City, and then you develop the same sort of problems that you get in the United States with diabetes, because people are less physically active. Maybe they have more of a white-collar job than a blue-collar job, and they're just, their diet is more of a fast food, processed food type of diet. And I think that's the real key.
Do you treat or consult with people who have diabetes to help them live more healthful lifestyles?
I do. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but I have worked with hundreds of individuals who've been both in my research studies and just that I've come across, where I help them sort out what would be a better lifestyle for them. It has to do with moving away from so much processed food and certain types of fats. My grandmother had type 2 diabetes, and she was the first person that I ever met that had diabetes besides myself, because I've actually had type 1 since 1968 when I was very young.
What did you see with your grandmother's case of diabetes? That was a very tough case.
I spent part of a summer with her when I was about 12, and she was constantly dieting, and she went on Weight Watchers again. I remember I had decided to help her with her diet. So when she went on the diet, I had her running laps around the backyard, and I was measuring out her cottage cheese and what she got to eat and weighing her in every day. And we'd made a deal that however much weight she lost, she was going to pay me $1 for each pound. And in that first week, she lost 8 pounds, which is not unheard of. I didn't realize that at the time, but I mean, I was a really rich kid. Can you imagine over 30 years ago making $8? What I also didn't realize at the time, though, is that after that initial rapid weight loss the first week, she probably didn't lose more than a pound or two after that, and then she gained it all back. So she was always quite overweight, and she ended up with all the cardiovascular complications that you can have that are related to diabetes. She had heart disease and She had a number of strokes, and she ended up having with lower leg amputations, and she was actually bedridden for her last 5 to 6 years and unable to communicate. And I looked at her and I said, I don't want to be like that. I want my life to be a better quality than that. I mean, what's the point of being alive for 6 years when you're in a bed and you can't feed yourself and you can't talk to anybody? So that was a really defining moment for me. That actually happened when I was in my 20s and I hadn't actually got my first blood glucose meter yet. But when I did get it, I decided I'm going to take control of this disease and I'm going to do what I can to manage it so that I don't end up like that.
You've written a number of books about diabetes, including The Diabetic Athlete's Handbook, 50 Secrets of the Longest Living People with Diabetes. You actually, though, have a positive message about it.
Oh, I do. I mean, I have seen the bad things that it can do, but I also realize that those are not inevitable. Whatever small steps you take in the right direction can have a very positive outcome for your diabetes management and your health in general. In fact, when I interviewed over 55 long-living people with diabetes for one of those books, what I realized when I came up with the 50 secrets was that those are things that would help you live long and well, period, whether you had diabetes or not. And they include things like having a physically active lifestyle. So even if you don't do planned exercise, you're just on your feet, go, go, go all day long, you're being active. You're not sitting around and playing video games all day. And you are watching your diet and you're trying to have a healthy diet and a healthy lifestyle and you're managing your stress and you're not letting diabetes just rule your life and make you depressed. So there's a big psychological component to living well with diabetes as well, that you really have to address that and say, I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to live positively. I'm going to live my life first. I'm going to be diabetic second. And the only way you can do that actually is by managing it effectively.
You wrote about a pair of brothers who both lived a very long time and both had this.
I did. The Cleveland brothers were very, very inspiring. The younger brother, Bob, he actually developed diabetes when he was 7 in 1925, which was only about a year or two after insulin became available in the larger cities, because it was only discovered in 1921. And so he was one of the first people who was on insulin. And he had all these stories to tell about the needles that they had to use that were as big as a horse needle. But he lived very well with diabetes, despite not having a blood glucose meter for many years, but he had a very healthy lifestyle. And he lived to be around 90. I mean, if all of us could live so long, that would be great, wouldn't it?
It would.
His older brother, Gerald, developed diabetes a little bit later in 1937. He lived to be 93. So they had an amazing life despite having diabetes, both of them.
You also wrote about a man who recently turned 100.
Right. At the age of 95, he set two records in the 95 and up category of the Senior Olympics. And he did the shot put, and then he did long jump, 6 feet, 7.5 inches. I want to ask how many people could actually do that now without hurting themselves. And he did it at the age of 95. So he's been quite an inspiration. And he made the news here last year because he and his new bride showed up at the courthouse to get married. And he was 98 at the time and she was 90. And they were the oldest people to ever go to the courthouse to get married.
Other secrets that you learned from these 55 people? You interviewed them, you re-interviewed them, a number of them years later.
They're all doing rather well. This is where the message that lifestyle is really important is paramount to living well with diabetes, because all of them had decided that they were going to live life first and be diabetic second. You know, they eat a lot of produce and good healthy stuff because that's what makes it better, easier for them to manage their diabetes. And I know very well for myself too that if you do that, there's a very good chance that you then can live well and long with diabetes, but you really have to make that decision for yourself.
You're such a believer in baby steps, which is very encouraging to those of us who aren't exercising enough. What's a nice way to sort of embark on a better exercise program?
I think if you're not doing anything currently, that the best thing that you can do is just start standing up more. I mean, you don't think of that as being a physical activity, but stand there for an hour, your legs will be tired and you'll be thinking about sitting down. So I usually start with that and just taking more steps during the day and, you know, just kind of ease into doing more. I mean, the worst thing is to start an activity program and A, have it be too intense so you don't want to do it anymore, which happens a lot, or just get yourself injured. So you don't want to get injured. And the best way to prevent that is to ease into it slowly. Do a variety of activities, try to find things that you really enjoy doing, all those things that are going to help motivate you to stay with it.
Sherry Kohlberg, thank you for talking with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you.
Sherry Kohlberg teaches exercise physiology and nutrition at Old Dominion University. Her latest book is Diabetes, No Problema. With Good Reason is made possible in part through the generosity of Anna and Tom Lawson and by the University of Virginia Children's Hospital, whose people strive to go beyond the expected in caring for the children of Virginia, uvahealth.com. Support is also provided by the Virginia 529 College Savings Plan, offering four tax-advantaged higher education savings plans for public and private technical schools, community colleges, and universities around the country and even the world. More information at virginia529.com. You're listening to With Good Reason, which is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzyk and Kelly Libby are our associate producers. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. We had help this week from Perry Smith of WHRV. Visit us at withgoodreasonradio.org or friend us on Facebook. For a free copy of the show on a CD, call 877-451-5098. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.